You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education Books podcast. I'm extremely honoured to have a very eminent scholar in the studio today. Angus Deaton of Princeton University is my guest. Hello.
Hello.
Professor Deaton is the Dwight D. Eisenhower Professor of Economics and International Affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs and the Economics Department at Princeton. He was stolen away, I believe, in 1983.
That's correct.
From the UK and has been in America since then.
Yes.
The reason Professor Deaton is my guest today is we are discussing his new book, The Great Escape: Health, Wealth, and the Origins of Inequality. And not too much about Steve McQueen.
Okay.
But a passing reference. Of course, the film is what pops into people's minds. I thought it was fascinating the way you talk about the fact that we focus in that film on the people who did escape. And of course, there are many other people who didn't. Your book focuses perhaps in a different way, more on seeing the big positive picture rather than the big negative picture, which is perhaps something that people reading headlines in the West at the moment, in the UK or in the US, have front and center in their minds. The picture seems bleak to a lot of people. This book, in focusing on material living standards and health, is a more positive message. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, I think it is fair to say. Certainly, I think over the last 250 years, wonderful things have happened to the world in terms of material well-being, and in terms of health, and in terms of a bunch of other things too. I mean, like democracy, the reductions in violence. I mean, the world really is, I think, a better place. The trouble, of course, is it's, as you said about the Great Escape, it's only for some. A lot of people, on the other hand, there are a lot of people who really never made it out. It's not totally optimistic, I think, because at the very end, I reflect that 250 years is not such a long time in the broad span of things, and we could break it all.
And of course, perhaps the fact that we tend to look at what is missing in the West from a position of relative prosperity shouldn't be dismissed out of hand.
Absolutely not.
You were born in 1945. You were part of what some people would say is the lucky generation. Mm-hmm. I was really touched by your own story discussed in the book about your father, about you and your sister being the first people in your family to go to university, and your father's efforts to study and become a civil engineer. Mm-hmm. That is a story that we've heard from other people in that generation, but it's not a story that happened to everyone in your generation.
Absolutely. Because my cousins, who were the same cohort as me, didn't go to university. Some of them did very well, but they didn't have that opportunity in the same way that my sister and I did. And also, you know, the cohort of my father's generation, few of them managed to do what he did. And then if you come down yet another generation, when I talk to my friends about their kids,
yes,
there's just not the automatic presumption that they will do so much better than their parents, our friends, did, that there was like a generation ago. So I think there's a lot of threat and anxiety there about people really wondering whether this progress can go on. And the data do indeed suggest that's one of the really worrying trends, that in most of the rich countries of the world, the growth engine that's been pushing this forward is slowing down.
And are we merely being selfish by saying, oh gosh, that great post-war boom in which many, many people became more prosperous than their parents had been? Is it selfish of us to expect that to continue when basic advances are still being worked toward in a lot of the rest of the world? Are we just saying we've had it good and we want it to keep on being good and hang the rest of the world?
Well, I don't think those two things contradict each other. I mean, you could want it for you and want it for other people too. I don't think there's some, you know, total sum that says if we get it, they don't, or if they get it, we don't. Though there are perhaps elements of that, but I don't think that's the big picture at all. So we don't have to sacrifice our prosperity for the prosperity of the people who've not made it.
But many people see it as a world of finite resources. For example, people who argue against changes in taxation say that what you take away from the wealthy to give to the poor means, you know, a net loss for the wealthy.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. But, I mean, then we're talking about what happens within countries. We don't have an international global taxation system that can take money away from people like us and give it to people in India or in Sierra Leone or wherever you would like to do something.
You said that that your children and grandchildren live in a world of wealth and opportunity that would have been a far-fetched fantasy in a Yorkshire coalfield.
Yeah.
How did you decide to put in things about yourself and about your family? Economics, like many scholarly subjects, and you know there are many different kinds of books in every discipline, but taking the author out of the picture is often the norm in a scholarly book.
Well, this is as much a popular book as a scholarly book, and I wrote that preface very, very late. It's not in almost any version up until the very end. And I think it's been very successful in that it did what I wanted to do, which was pull people in. And also it is a sort of metaphor for the book, which is that, you know, if you multiply that over and over and over again, that's the story of what's happened, you know, not to everybody, but to a lot of people around the Western world over the last 60, 70 years. And, you know, that's been the great success of one of the great successes of our times. And so I thought it was a good way to tell it personally and that people would lock onto it and that it would be a good preface.
Maybe there's a case sometimes for a little more of that, particularly when you're addressing a broader public. People are perhaps people who don't come from a business background who feel that it's incumbent on them to see what Alan Krugman has to say about things or to see what other high-profile scholars such as yourself. If you're not interested in business, if you're not reading the Wall Street Journal, many people tend to stay away from books by economists.
Well, I hope not.
Gosh, I've just put my foot in my mouth there, obviously.
No. I think that's true. But I think that there's quite a lot of good books out there over the last few years where economists are trying to reach a broader audience and also trying to undercut some of the misperceptions that we're a very narrow bunch, you know, that's not interested in who gets what, just in the total amount, that we're totally interested in efficiency and getting things done and not at all interested in distribution or inequality and things, and that we're very narrow and we don't think about things like health and so on, and nothing could be further from the truth. So if this book helps break that a little bit, I'd be very pleased, but I'm certainly not the only one who's trying to do that.
Since you moved to the United States, presumably you've seen a number of changes there. I know that you've written a letter from America for the Royal Economic Society. Starting in 1996, you did pieces. And I looked at the first piece you wrote in this Letters from America series. You were talking about David Card and Alan Krueger, very eminent fellow economists and present and past Princeton colleagues, I believe.
Yep.
This piece on the minimum wage and what President Clinton had been doing at the time, what really struck me in that piece was not necessarily the discussions over whether paying people a minimum wage was a good or bad thing, and that seems to be continuing, but you discussed the vituperation with which those economists were greeted when they discussed the results of a study that said that increasing the minimum wage did not necessarily increase unemployment. I found it quite shocking to see that scholars as eminent as them had, obviously, there was a political motivation for people attacking them. Does this still happen? Does it happen?
Oh, absolutely. I was listening to radio in my car the other day and someone was attacking that same paper 20 years later. Brought it out for a beating again. So anything that really gets at the vested interests of the rich, you're going to get an enormous amount of outpouring, because they have a lot of money to oppose this with. And you're just going to hear about it for sure. And that still happens. And it happens on both sides. I mean, I don't know if you've followed the recent public pillorying of Ken Rogoff and Carmen Reinhart, for instance, which I think has a lot of very, very troubling features to it. And the attack that was mounted on them should have been handled academically in the first instance, but it was actually sent to the world press the same day it was sent to them. So they didn't see it until it appeared in the Financial Times. So, you know, things, when the stakes are high, everything goes out of the window, I think. And you do get that. So that is one of the things that interests me, which is the extent to which politics is deeply tied up in these things. And I think it's maybe a little more hidden here in Britain than it is in the United States, where it's very blatant.
Especially where funding comes from many sources, influential private donors, and so on.
Right.
I noticed that in a more recent letter, one in from America in your Royal Economic Society series, you wrote about essentially, this is in 2011, essentially fat cat economists who disguise the sources of their funding or the source their involvement in policy advice.
Right.
So essentially, these
So much policy advice. It's more that, you know, they're on the boards of pharmaceutical companies and they're writing papers about how great pharmaceuticals are.
Surely this is, in many people's view, that would be academic misconduct in a way to not discuss your.
I think a lot of us agree with that. The trouble is, how are you going to police it? And, you know, there's an American Economic Association, but we don't have. So we didn't even have a code of conduct. Now we have a code of conduct, which says, you know, you shall do certain things. But, you know, if people choose not to do that, what could we do? We're not a court of law. We don't give people licenses.
It does seem, I suppose, understandable that the economists are often approached to provide advice. Surely, of course, in the UK, the REF would suggest that this is impact, and if you are having an impact on the powerful, who wouldn't want an economist to give them advice if they were running a big, influential business or people in a sector?
No, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with doing it. There's something wrong with doing it and then not. You know, flying under false colors seems like a bad idea. I think it's probably worse in the medical profession.
Of course.
And, you know, you do think the dangers are, you know, and doctors proclaiming their research, what purports to be research and is actually being done by the pharmaceutical companies. So.
Yes, we've had a number of high-profile cases here where whistleblowers have had extreme difficulty subsequent to bringing those things up.
Yep.
So on the one hand, in 96, you're talking about scholars who were respected, rigorous, published the results of research.
They were younger then than they are now, of course.
We all are.
Yeah.
And were accused of, I guess, political motivation, and yet the funding for their research was certainly not coming from it wasn't coming from the trades unions, it was coming from a business organization, if I remember correctly, or funding that was...
I think the funding for the attacks was.
I'm not sure that they
had any funding. The funding for the attacks was coming from the trade organization of fast food chains.
Who, of course, had a vested interest in keeping wages...
I mean, vested interests have to argue this. And I mean, you have to, in the end, discuss the arguments on their own quality. And just because the argument is made by someone you don't like or who's doing something disreputable, it doesn't make it a bad argument. But it seems like a good idea for people to say who's paying them when they're doing these things. So you can take that into account.
The stakes are high in economics research, I take it. Your head is above the parapet much more than if you're a medievalist.
That's probably true. But, you know, medievalist heads are not very far above the parapet. I'm not sure economists are all that far above the parapet either, compared with maybe doctors, for instance. But it's true. I think economists do hold a lot of the levers of power. And so that makes these debates really seriously worth having.
And what about influence on policy? As an economist yourself, do you not see opportunities when you've found out something of value and see how it could be deployed in a positive sense. Do you not want to have your advice asked by politicians? Do you not want an opportunity to speak to them?
Yeah, I think that's a matter of personal taste.
Right. How do you feel?
Well, I feel that I like to write books like The Great Escape or to do even, you know, more fundamental research, which I think will have an effect on time, in time, because it changes the way people think about things. So I want to be one step back from the people who are actually whispering the ears of princes and so on. But, I mean, I have colleagues like Alan Krueger, whose name has already come up. Ben Bernanke was my boss for a long time.
Right.
You know, he was at
yes.
my wedding.
Close to the levers of power.
Yeah, and, you know, so, and a lot of people, a lot of economists really want to do that. I mean, they do want to run the world. I mean, Larry Summers is another good friend who's been another example of that. And I think of Larry as one of the smartest people I've ever met and could have been a great, great academic, but he wanted to do this. So people, you know, there are people like that who want to do it right on the, you know, they want to run the world. And some of them get the chance to do that.
Do you think it's easier for American academics in particular disciplines to have access to that than, say, in the UK?
I'm not sure. I think there's been a fair amount.
Of course, the nudge unit here.
Yeah, but I mean, when I was a young, just starting out, Mervyn King and I used to play tennis every day.
You know, and so, who was the better player?
Well, we were about the same. We were both terrible.
That's
We were, you know, very young, cocky academics. I think we were like 24 years old, and we were just complaining mostly that people had not given us professorships yet.
You know, you had only just completed your doctorate at Cambridge.
I don't think
at that point.
I'm not sure I even started my doctorate at that point. But you know, that was the phase when there were all these new young universities, and you know, smart young people were getting professorships very early. So I remember Tony Atkinson, now Sir Tony Atkinson, going off to become a professor at Essex at the age of 26 or something.
My
like
goodness.
That. So we all thought that should happen to us.
To you all.
And, but, I mean, those people have been very policy influential. Lord Stern, Nick Stern, has been my best friend for a long, long, long time, and he's been very influential in policy. So, you know, I don't think it's so hard here.
Was it a hard decision to go to America after you were so cruelly scorned of a professorship at 24? Is that what made you set your sights?
I think I got a professorship when I was 29 or something.
Okay, so
it wasn't. I didn't have to wait so long. That's right. No, it was a difficult time here. I mean, I was at the University of Bristol, and you know, Mrs. Thatcher was wielding axes in the directions of the university, and Bristol was not very well set up to handle that, and so it became very, very unpleasant. And it was also a time when, you know, you couldn't make a phone call without the vice chancellor's permission, sort of idea. I mean, that was maybe a little bit of an exaggeration, but not much.
It must have felt like that as a young
It really felt like
came
that,
to get things
and it
done.
Was not terrific. So, you know, it just came a time when I started taking the letters seriously, and Princeton's been very, very good to me.
How do you see the UK having changed when you come back? Do you come back fairly often?
Fairly often, but it's hard because you lose the sort of instinct for what's going on. And America seemed very strange to me when I first went there. I remember going to Princeton, and there was a professor there in my department who liked to endorse the Proudhon statement about government being theft.
Right.
And I thought, oh, my God, what sort of place would I come to where my colleagues think government is stuff? But, you know, after about a decade in the United States, I realized that was pretty descriptively accurate as to what was going on. You know? So you really do get a sense of it being the polities are really very different. And things have changed here a lot, I think.
You've given an account elsewhere of speaking to a policeman in New York City when you were 19 on your first visit, a traffic cop asking him for directions and getting a stream of abuse.
Yes. Well, the cops in New York are not the same as the bobbies in Edinburgh, I guess, is the answer.
Do you feel like an American now?
I became an American 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago. And well, thank you. I'm not sure whether I should be congratulated on it, but I think once you have grandchildren, and I have three grandchildren in America who are not going to live anywhere else, it seemed quite foolish not to be an American citizen. I'm still a British citizen, so.
What do you miss about the UK Academy? Obviously, the weather.
I was
going to
say cricket and the weather and things. What, but
is there anything, obviously, what's not to like about Princeton as a place for a scholar? But there
well,
must
there's
have been
lots
things
of things not to like about it, actually.
Oh, okay. Would you like to give us a list?
No, I'm not going to give you a list.
Okay.
But, well, the things that you can like is the place has an infinite sum of money, and that surely helps. And so never when I've been at Princeton and I've needed money not just to make a telephone call but to do almost any legitimate thing, there's been money forthcoming. It's a very, very... There's something I really liked at Bristol, but it's very hard to separate these things out from a particular time and place in your life,
and
the people and the things and what it was. But, you know, when I was at Cambridge and when I was at Bristol, it was not everybody was a superstar in the way that they try to make it happen at Princeton. And when everybody's a superstar, there's a lot of egos bashing up against each other all the time. And there's not a lot of, in the British departments I was in, there were people who didn't do a huge amount of work, but they sat around and talked to people. And they were very important catalysts for other people's ideas. And those people can't survive in the top American institutions where it's sort of publish or perish carried to extremes. Now, I'm sure that's happened here to some extent, too. I mean, it's much harder now with all the assessments and all the rest of it for people like that. But if you go back in the history of economics, it was true. I mean, I remember reading about Keynes and his followers in Cambridge, and they all thanked this guy called Gerald Shove, spelled S-H-O-V-E. And no one's ever heard of that person now. He never wrote anything and so on. But he was terrifically important in talking to all these people and making those ideas happen. And without him, who knows, maybe they wouldn't have happened.
So it was part of the ecology and of the collegiality.
Of the thing. And that collegiality, I don't think, it's not very strong in my department. I think it varies a lot from department to department because it depends on personalities. But, I mean, I do think things have gotten much more brutal than they used to be.
So maybe the academic Tour de France needs some domestiques, people back in the peloton, not just the people in the yellow jerseys.
No, I think that would be a good thing.
And in terms of the UK, for other reasons, when you come back, do you feel great waves of nostalgia? Do you go to Edinburgh? Or are you just trapped in London talking to people like me?
I don't think there are people like you, other than you.
Thank you.
No, I mean, the world has gotten to be a much smaller place. So there used to be a sense in which you came back and it was really nice. You know, you could have Marmite or something, you know. But now I can get Marmite in my local supermarket, you know.
And
tablet?
Tablet.
Tablet's not good for you anyways. I don't eat tablet. But there are not that many things that you can't get. I mean, it really is sort of a smaller world. And, you know, there used to be no East Indian community in the United States when I first went there, and now it's really sort of a very large dominant community. So all of that stuff is there that used not to be like Indian food and lots of Indians and that sort of culture and so on. So the gaps seem to have gotten smaller.
I'd like to return to the book.
Okay.
You say, with regard to foreign aid, the need to do something tends to trump the need to understand what needs to be done. And it seems to me that some of what you're saying about foreign aid in this book will initially shock and disappoint people, mm-hmm. the idea that foreign aid can be a force for bad. I have associated that argument with selfish Westerners, supply-side economists, libertarians, people who think the third world should just get on and die by itself without the wealthy West underwriting their dictatorial governments. I have to say I felt abashed after reading your arguments and understood much better the argument that when governments are not accountable to their own citizens as taxpayers, if I understand correctly, that this can be a bad thing, and that the countries whose budgets are made up largely of foreign aid tend to be the ones that are most repressive and where conditions are the worst.
Right.
But it is... Is it, do you not fear that your argument that foreign aid, except for health, is a bad thing, will be used by people who perhaps care less about the developing world than you do?
Yeah, I can't help that. I mean, you know, the argument stands on its own two legs. And, I mean, the arguments are very different from those arguments. I mean, you sometimes feel that from the hard right, they just don't care, and there's no sense of obligation. And I certainly accept that. Obligation. So I'm very angry that we're doing harm, or I think we're doing harm. And actually, I don't even exempt health. I think the health, it's very easy to see the good that's being done when it's being done. So, for instance, there are clearly a lot of people alive today who would have been dead if they had not had antiretroviral therapy, which was largely paid for by the West. So that's certainly a good thing, and we should count that on the positive side. But I think the argument is just the one that you just made, that the undermining of government is always present, whether it's health or not. And in the end, you know, these people are on antiretrovirals, need to be on antiretrovirals that are paid for by local taxation and provided for by their own government. Otherwise, they're at the whims of taxpayers in other countries. So I think there was a Canadian election in which this issue came up at some point, in which, you know, we shouldn't be spending all this money on HIV/AIDS. We should be looking at maternal and child health, which is a reasonable argument. But why should that argument in a Canadian election affect the lives of people in Africa? Because it's for them to decide about this. So, I mean, on the health aid for that, I think I would do something like, say, let's give it 10 years, and by the end we won't be doing this anymore. And that'll give local people time to organize and, you know, press their own governments in order to be providing this for themselves. I mean, that happened in South Africa, for example. You know, you had Mbeki there, who was not very keen, to say the least, of using these drugs at all to help people. And there was an enormous local campaign of agitation. I mean, that's the way it's supposed to happen, in that it bubbles up from below, and then, you know, it's legitimized and it's for real. So I'm not denying the lives that are saved, or the schools that are built, or the roads that are built. But there's always this undermining, and it's not in the long run sustainable without the government on board. I mean, one of the things I think people here in rich countries ought to think about is what it would be like if their government stops functioning.
The fantastic example you give of a Swedish charity telling America that they would have to legalize same-sex marriages unless, if they wanted to continue to receive aid.
Yeah.
It certainly turns the view around in ways that, of course, people in the West who feel like they want to help the developing world think of themselves as kind people with a global outlook. Never. I think it's very easy to overlook that perspective of what it feels like to you.
Well, it is good to turn it on its head. Though it's interesting, I gave a talk in the philosophy department at Princeton the other day in a debate with Peter Singer over the aid issue. And they, with this example of the Swedes coming and saying, you know, and they said, bring it on.
You know, of course.
They had no trouble with it at all. So maybe it wasn't the best picked example.
By the time you're an eminent scholar, which I think is fair to say, rather than just the eminent scholar in the making at 24 playing tennis with Mervyn King, when you have a debate with a fellow economist who may be in your general sort of level of eminence,
mm-hmm.
did the gloves ever come off, or is it more just two grand men? I mean, do you feel like fights ever get personal in those, or quite fierce in those situations? Or do you sheath your claws?
No, it's a good question. I never really thought about it. I don't do a lot of that. I mean, a lot of eminent scholars try to avoid each other, I think. And it's hard to arrange these debates so they don't... And they can get very vituperative without people actually facing each other at all. Sort of interesting. I don't know if you've been following, but there's been this pair of books on India, one by Amartya Sen and Chandra's, and the other by Jagdish Bhagwati and Arvind Panagariya. And Amartya Sen has basically just taken the high ground and refuses to debate. And Bhagwati is throwing out ever more vituperative attacks.
Trying to provoke a response.
Trying to sort of provoke a response. And it's sort of very unpleasant. There's certainly an issue. I've been debating, not so much debating, I have come to believe that randomized trials are not a very good idea.
Right.
And but it's very hard for me. I mean, the people at MIT, who are my friends, and maybe they just want to preserve that, but as hard as other people have tried to set up debates, they sort of don't happen, or they won't argue.
It must become more difficult, of course, when, on the one hand, if you honestly believe, for example, that aid policies are leading to a lot of deaths, one must feel, well, I need to make this argument, I need to destroy the other person's argument or show up the flaws in it, because it's not merely a question of who's top dog in the senior common room, but lives of millions of people.
Yeah, but you know, the media is so thick and diverse these days that most of this can take place without. It's not clear the face-to-face confrontations that would have happened in Victorian England or early 20th century
the
England.
Scopes child.
Yes, that sort of thing, that you sort of really need that anymore, because there's plenty of ways of doing that off that thing. So I think, for instance, my friend Bill Easterly tells me that he's never debated Jeff Sachs one-on-one. Isn't and you see, you might have thought that that
they
was not
would have
true.
Had the opportunity.
And you might have felt that that debate has been going on, and it has, but it's not ever happened, you know, in a sort of packed lecture hall.
So it's kind of an epistolary fight, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Or through books.
Your concern about health inequality and health issues in this book, obviously, a lot of the focus is on the developing world. Your positioned in a country in which there is a health inequality situation that those of us lucky enough to come from a country that still has a national healthcare system would find unbelievably cruel and improbable to.
I'm not sure that's true, though. I mean, the health inequalities in the UK are pretty bad, too. So, I mean, one of the puzzles is that countries with full... I mean, when Britain introduced the National Health Service after the war, it was assumed these health inequalities would go away, and that was one of the reasons for introducing the health system. And people really didn't stopped studying the topic, which had been studied since the middle of the 19th century. And then sometime in the mid-60s and so on, people discovered they were still there. And I'm not sure they're quite so glaring as they are in the United States, but the U.S. has this big issue of race that sort of poisons everything in a very different way than almost anywhere else. But there are big health inequalities in Britain, too.
And there's private medicine here, which of course allows certain people access to...
Yeah, but I don't think that's much of it.
It's not the issue of whether you have flowers in your private hospital room so much as...
I think that probably helps, but also I think, you know, if you're a high-status civil servant or something and you get sick, you get dealt with by rather different people than you would if you were, you know, poor in Birmingham or something.
But still in all, there are... operations that people can't get health insurance coverage for in the United States that would be done for
I agree with
free
that.
Here.
Yep.
Do you think...
I'm not sure that does much for the gradient, though.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you think Obamacare will improve things?
Yes, I do.
Do you think it will fly? Do
yeah,
you think it
I
has
do.
A...
it's the are law you, of the land, as they keep saying. Yeah.
Are you surprised at the number of people who argue against their own interests, who have been... it seems to observers elsewhere duped into believing that this is some kind of some kind of evil Marxist attempt to in fact if they had a national healthcare system they would be better off.
I think there's a lot of confusion for sure, which is that you know, people have what one of my colleagues called loosely constructed belief systems.
That's a really good insult. You know, I'll have to use that when I want to say someone's dim.
Well, or it's just that they can believe things that are manifestly contradictory at the same time. So, you know, people like to make fun of people saying, you know, who proclaim the slogan, you know, get the government's hands off Medicare, which is, of course, a government program. You know, they somehow think it's not. So there's a fair amount of that going on. But there is a very strong streak in the United States that's much, much stronger than it is here of distrust for government. And I spend 5 weeks in Montana every summer, which is a part of the United States
where distrust of the government.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily a completely red state. The Democrats control both houses and the governor, though they're different sort of Democrats than you would meet in New York. And they have very, very good reasons for distrusting the federal government. Because it's done bad things to them over and over and over again historically. And also because they feel their lives are being run by...
somewhere far away.
Some people far away who are very different from them, who have very different interests. I mean, it's a very big country, and it is sort of like the Greeks being governed by the Germans or something. I mean, there's this sense that those people don't really have their interests at heart. You know, they have their own loosely constructed belief systems about the way farming operates, for example.
Well, Westminster is not very far away from South Shields, but perhaps the same thing.
There's perhaps some of the way, but this is just an enormous gap. So there is a lot of folly of people just not understanding what government's capable of doing. But there's this very strong and genuine sort of libertarian streak that believes that people really ought to fend for themselves, and that's much, much stronger than it is here. And so a lot of people just don't want the government involved in healthcare at all, and they'll take their chances. And I don't think that even if they would like it when they're sick, they believe it ought to be there. So, I mean, there are people who have tightly constructed belief systems who are still sort of opposed to it.
You say quite charmingly, if this book were much longer and its author knew more, which is a very humble thing to say. What I would like to know is perhaps if this book were not longer, but maybe what books lie ahead. And if its author knew more, if you had the magic power to find out any bit of economic data, or, you know, if you could magic up a giant mass observation project of a different kind in America, if there were any data that you could have to crunch that you don't have or is difficult to get, what would it be?
That's a good question. I don't really think about it that way. There's a lot of data out there in the sense that if you can conceive what it is you want, I don't think one's as constrained by the absence of data as many people seem to think. I mean, there are two strands that I think should be in the book or not. One I talk about, which is education. And that's just because, you know, it would be a much bigger book. The other one, which I come to realize sort of late and I don't really know much about, is migration. Because if you think of the story I tell about my father and me and my kids, that involves, I mean, some of the great escapes are actually made by people moving their feet.
Plenty of Scots to Canada,
Of Scots to Canada and Scots to England, and, you know, English to Scots, as my dad went. So I think that is really quite important, and there's a good story to be told there. I mean, the other thing that I'm very interested in, which you raised, are these health inequality issues, because I don't think we understand very well what those are. And everybody comes at it thinking they know what the answer is, but most of those answers are contradictory. And there's just a lot of stuff out there that we don't really know, and it seems like a really important issue. So I'd like to do more on that.
So concrete plans for the next book, or?
Well, one idea was to turn these letters from America that you've been reading into something like a book. There are some good ones in there which could be extended into chapters.
Have you looked back on any of them recently?
Some of them I look back on with a little bit of embarrassment. Some of them...
sums wrong?
Sorry. For instance, the minimum wage one that you talked about is... I'm not quite so sure it's quite so black and white as I made it seem in that thing. It's complicated, and we don't understand it very well. I try not to say that word. My wife always says, you know, if you ask Angus to tell you why something is, he'll always say it's complicated, which is the typical academic answer, you know, which is not really what you want to hear. But there are others, like I wrote when I had my hip replaced, and that actually became quite a famous piece in the end because the New York Times wrote it up. And at my son's wedding, there were some women who came and said, "Yo, you're the hip guy." So my hip was more famous than I was for a while. But there's a lot of good medical stories like that that illustrate things that I think people don't understand very well.
So. Professor Deighton, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.